Since then, the U.S. regime approved a potential multi-billion dollar deal with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And in August, the Biden administration granted the Saudi crown prince immunity from a civil lawsuit over his role in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Biden was reportedly humiliated earlier this year after allegedly bringing up the Khashoggi killing to the crown prince, who fired back by citing the Zionist regime killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghla, asking why Jamal Khashoggi mattered more. Notably, the U.S. head of state failed a number of times to even pronounce Shirin Abu Aghla's name correctly when delivering a speech just days earlier and did not bring the killing up to Israeli regime representatives. The White House insinuated in its opposition to Senator Bernie Sanders' resolution on Yemen and that it had a hand in the six-month-long ceasefire between the two primary opposing sides in the war. The reality was that it was the UN that brokered the ceasefire, which ended on October 2nd. The day following Sanders' withdrawal of his power resolution, two fuel shipments carrying tons of diesel were seized by the Saudi-led coalition and prevented from reaching Yemen. The blockade of Yemen is one of the major factors contributing to the resurgence of tensions. The Biden administration has so far proven ineffective at bringing the Saudis under its wing in the way it had hoped, indicating that its foreign policy tactics have proven ineffective at best. The U.S. regime has shown that it cannot be trusted to keep its word, as was proven by other things. Regardless of how things go, it is clear that the U.S. influence in the Arabian Peninsula is rapidly declining, and part of its legacy will be this brutal war that has cost upwards of 400,000 lives, and that the Biden administration has refused to end.
If you agree with me that travel is most rewarding when it surprises, then Iran might just be the most rewarding destination on Earth. By having lush, dense forests in the north, warm, sunny beaches in the south by the Persian Gulf, snowy mountains in the west, and amazingly hot deserts in the east, Iran is one of the few countries that gives the joy of experiencing four different seasons at the same time to travelers. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. With an area of 1.6 million square kilometers, Iran is the 18th largest country in the world and the second largest in the Middle East. Its area roughly equals the area of France, Spain, and Germany together. Iran's diverse and striking landscapes offer a wealth of breathtaking and spectacular views to discover. This week on Aperture's Iran Trotter series, Jawad Gharayi will go to Bahu Kalat in the south of Iran, where the turquoise waters meet the hot sand of the desert. Here's the first part.
The living world is filled with unparalleled beauties. Beauties represented by Mother Nature across this beautiful planet. A planet that's been the only habitat for humans since they came into being millions of years ago. The beauties of nature have forever captivated humans everywhere. Many of what humans have created over millennia were inspired by their natural environment. To many humans, the word nature conjures up images of mountains and forests, but nature has thousands of other beautiful facets, and some of those facets manifest themselves in sharp contrast to each other. One of the most beautiful faces of Mother Nature is the barren areas of land, or deserts. Many nature explorers believe that deserts and steppes are the most beautiful parts of nature, and the most beautiful parts of these parts are the sand dunes and hills. But is there anywhere in the world with expanses of shifting dry sand dunes right next to a great body of salt water named the sea? Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of this beautiful land. Chile is a beautiful country with unique natural exquisiteness. A country that remarkably has vast steppes and shifting sand dunes along the coast of the Pacific Ocean, offering a natural scene of unparalleled beauty. Of course, I haven't traveled to Chile's beautiful Pacific coast. My destination is the Bahu Kalat rural district in the south of Iran's Sistan and Baluchistan province. But I'm not going straight to Bahu Kalat. I begin my trip near the border between Hormozgan and Sistan and Baluchistan provinces. There are few places in the world where sand dunes meet the sea, creating a spectacular landscape. Such coastal deserts can only be seen in parts of Chile, in the Great African Sahara, and in the Southwest African country of Namibia. Some may find it hard to believe, but in addition to those few places in the world, there is an area in southern Iran where expansive sand fields meet the Sea of Oman. A place near the village of Darak in Zaravan County. The border between Sistan and Baluchistan and Hormozgan provinces, in the southernmost area of Baluchistan on the coast of the Sea of Oman. In the past, this area of Iran was called Mukran, a name researchers say was derived from the word muk, meaning the palm tree. Given its large number of palm groves, Baluchistan can be referred to as the land of palm groves in Iran, an area with a beautiful history and peerless natural splendor. Unfortunately, the general public in Iran doesn't know much about Balochistan. The sea, the sand dunes, and the Martian mountains, all in one place, provide an environment with no parallel in Iran and, I dare say, in the world. But the sand dunes, the Martian mountains, and the Sea of Oman aren't the only things that make this area of Balochistan unique. It's the multitudes of palm and other trees scattered along this area, as well as the many herds of camels, goats, and sheep grazing among these dunes and mountains that make for breathtaking beauty. Here, Mother Nature has made all her efforts to create some of the most beautiful coastal sceneries in the world, and she's done a great job. This is the result of millions of years of work for Mother Nature. So it's incumbent upon us and the authorities to keep these unmatched beauties just as they are, by not allowing any structures, however small, to be built here or in the surrounding area. Not even a few gazebos for tourists and explorers to use. We have to preserve this natural magnificence as it is. A geopark is a unified area that advances the protection and use of geological heritage in a sustainable way and promotes the economic well-being of the people who live in it. Geoparks are protected areas. Many countries dream of having one in its smallest and simplest shape and form. There are only a few geoparks around the world that are both geomorphologically rich and boast unique wildlife, history, culture, and indigenous populations. Countries with such wealth are few and far between. But this area of Balochistan is home to several morphological splendors. It's also inhabited by Baluch tribes of a rich culture, their traditional lifestyle and time-honored customs, a pure, unspoiled natural environment, the preserved remains from the remote past, the golden sandy coastlines, and the deep turquoise blue waters of the Sea of Oman. The traditional fishing apparatus on boats moored at a beautiful port, and finally, very good vegetation and animal life. As I walk on beautiful sand hills, I think to myself, how are we responsible to the generations that will come into being in this country, to the natural beauties in our country? I'm spending today relishing the stunning untapped natural beauties in Zaravan and snapped several beautiful pictures. The nagging question is, do we have the right to deny the children of tomorrow the opportunity to feast their eyes on such spectacular scenery? I wish no structure, no roads, nothing would be built among these ancient mountains, sand dunes, and palm groves. No hotels, no themed amusement parks to be built for human recreation on its untouched coastline. Even a few simple gazebos in the area can accelerate the destruction of this region's ecology and natural landscape. I wish all of us humans had more appreciation for the natural world, this manifestation of God Almighty's beauty, and paid it due respect. I wish all nature-loving tourists would choose to walk into the heart of nature, and by doing so prevent it any harm to it. A lot of people in the world think that if they really want to enjoy their expedition into nature, they have to spend the night in multi-star hotels near their destinations. But that's not the right mentality. It's not in anyone's interests. Hotels that are built close to natural habitats do nothing but damage an intricate ecology that's taken millennia to be formed. There's an alternative way for explorers to both enjoy their trips into the heart of nature and for the natural world to be spared damage by humans. In other words, for humans to forge a partnership with the natural world. Local homes, campfires and black tents, and also camping tents are the best options. All the people and officials in this area of Balochistan say they hope that in the near future, the area they live in will be registered as an important and valuable geopark by the relevant authorities living in the capital city. And by doing so, they hope the unique natural environment here and the culture and customs of the old Baloch tribes inhabiting this region will be preserved and protected. I take great pleasure walking about in this beautiful natural landscape and accompanying camel herders, but this is the end of this leg of my journey. I have to set off for my main destination, the Bahu Kalat district in the north of Balochistan. The main purpose of this trip is to visit an idyllic little village by the name of Shir Gawaz, a lush, vast green patch of land 30 kilometers to the border with Pakistan. The name Shir Gawaz was derived from the names of two wild animals, namely the lion and the boar. The locals here tell me this area is home to wild boars, but no one has ever sighted any trace of lions here or anywhere in Iran, unless in the very distant past. Perhaps what ancient Shir Gawaz inhabitants meant by the word lion was in fact the wolf or hyena. That's because those two species have lived in this region for hundreds of years. But what has brought me to this area of Balochistan wasn't the lion or the boar. I've come here to see the Asian crocodile. Parlance, this rare species of crocodile is called the Gondo. They live somewhere between River Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gawaz. The river is the biggest natural stream of water in Balochistan. It is known by different names by the locals living in villages located along its 300-kilometer course. Monikers such as Sarbaz, Bahu Kalat, and Shir Gawaz. My team and I have to walk a long distance to see one of those short-nosed crocodiles. But these gorgeous, thick-skinned aquatic reptiles in Iran are said to be very shy animals, making it difficult for us to find one. What that means is you can't get too close to these amphibians and admire their beauty at close range. We have been going about gunning for a crocodile for a couple of hours now, but we haven't been able to see even one just yet. As I say, they are very shy animals. The locals tell me I'd be lucky to see one, though they also say if you wait long enough, you'll definitely be able to see at least one. Guide is around 3 meters long. The people in this area call them the Gondo. Who would have thought that you could see Gondos, the short-nosed Asian crocodiles, in a river in Iran's Sistan and Balochistan province? At their biggest, these majestic reptiles are 3.5 meters long. The primary habitats of the short-nosed Asian crocodile are in Iran, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Myanmar. The people of Shirgwaz tell me the best place to see the gondos is the Shirgwaz Dam, a barrier built across the Shirgwaz River to impound its water. The number of crocodiles living in Iran has been estimated at between 300 and 400. The good news is the people of Sistan and Balochistan do not do anything to endanger the survival of these adorable reptiles. The bond between them is unshakable. In general, the Baluch are kind, nature-loving human beings, traits that are rooted in these noble people's culture and creed. The love of nature and of animals is part of the life and culture of the Baluch people. Animals are part of the family, among them wild animals. Probably if this were another city or country, many people would try and, man, this guy is strong. I bet if I let him go, he's definitely gonna break my bones or break my camera into pieces. As I was saying, if this mountain goat were anywhere other than here, without a doubt some heartless poacher would have gunned it down by now. But the people here love animals dearly. The gondos that we saw earlier, they're conserving them so well. Also this wild goat, that's very close to the hearts of the people here. You can see many peacocks, partridges, and pheasants in the households here in Shirgwaz, and also in other villages elsewhere in Balochistan. The Shirgwaz River flows past Bahu Kalad village, providing the hard-working community here with water for their farms, fruit groves, and animals. Perhaps there are many people in Iran who are unaware that the fruits grown in Balochistan can only be farmed in tropical climates. But that's exactly what's happening in this province. All of the Iranian banana produce comes from this region. Bahu Kalad is also among the important producers of watermelons in Iran. The cold season is when the watermelons grown here are harvested and distributed across the country. I've just stepped into a fruit grove in Bahu Kalad. In my opinion, this is a veritable piece of heaven. Here, you can see several different species of fruits right next to each other. Something you may not be able to see anywhere else in Iran. Fruits such as bananas, dates, mangoes, papaya, all kinds of citrus fruits. I've also been told that even coffee is farmed in some of the gardens here. It's just wonderful. I mean, you could go so far as calling this place Little India, located in southwestern Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime forces and settlers have killed 159 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, in the West Bank in 2022, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. 2022 has been the deadliest for Palestinian deaths based on the monthly average of deaths, which is the highest since the UN began recording fatalities in 2005. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, an Israeli border police officer shot and killed a Palestinian man at point-blank range in the town of Hubara, near the West Bank city of Nablus recently. The harrowing incident, captured on video recorded from multiple angles, comes days after Kobi Shabati, the Zionist regime's police chief, praised officers for killing a Palestinian who, they allege, carried out a car ramming attack at a checkpoint. Shabati claimed after Rani Mamoun Fayez Abu Ali, 45, was killed recently, a dead terrorist is what I want to see. Shabati's comments are not the first from a senior officer encouraging field executions of Palestinians. Human rights groups have long accused the Zionist regime's civilian leadership, in words of B'Tselem, of responsibility of transformation of police officers and even armed civilians into judges and executioners who slay Palestinians suspected of armed attacks in the streets. The Palestinian executed in Hawara recently was identified as Ammar Hamdi Nayef Mefleh. Media outlets gave his age as 22 or 23. The fake regime of Israel claimed that the shooting was in response to a stabbing attack, but video appears to show that Mefleh was not holding anything in his hands when he was shot and killed. And as the Tel Aviv-based newspaper Haaretz acknowledged, an eyewitness who was at the scene contradicted the police's version of events, saying that an armed settler who passed by the checkpoint provoked several people who were standing near a restaurant eating lunch when a fight broke out between him and Ammar Mefleh. Video of the moments before the shooting shows two men attempting to pull Mefleh from the grasp of an Israeli regime border police officer before the officer succeeds in breaking away from the men with his arm around Mefleh's neck. The video shows Mefleh breaking away from the officer's grip before he starts hitting the officer and grabbing at his rifle. In quick succession, the rifle drops to the ground, apparently from Mefleh's hands, and Mefleh backs away from the troop, who opens fire at Mefleh with a handgun and then runs over to pick up his rifle. At no time does Mefleh appear to attempt to use the rifle or do anything other than defend himself from the armed Israeli regime officer. Notably, according to the account of a Palestinian eyewitness, Mefleh had already been shot and injured by an Israeli regime settler prior to this struggle with the border police officer who eventually killed him. Four shots can be heard in the video recording of the incidents. One video shows the final shot fired at Mefleh as the officer stands over him, indicating that he intended to confirm the kill. In any case, it is clear that Mefleh did not pose an imminent threat to the officer as he kept shooting at him. Palestinian outlets reported that Israeli regime forces prevented paramedics from providing medical care to Mefleh before taking his body away. The fabricated regime of Israel withholds the bodies of Palestinians killed during attacks, an alleged and attempt attack, so they may be used as bargaining chips in future negotiations. The eyewitness, possibly the same one cited by Haaretz, described to Palestinian media the events leading up to Mefleh's execution. He said that settlers in a car were harassing Mefleh, who tried to open the car door, at which point the settler drew his weapon and shot him, and shot at me, at my jeep. Then an Israeli regime officer approached, and instead of getting the settler away, he attacked the young man even more to finish him off, even though he was injured. It is at that point that the Palestinians scuffled with the officer as seen on the video. The officer didn't give him a chance to calm down. May God have mercy on him, the eyewitness said. The officer sprayed him with bullets. He let the settler just go on his way. The eyewitness said that Mefleh never even touched the settler. He just touched his car. The Zionist regime media reported that a Palestinian man attempted to attack an Israeli couple who were in their car near Hawara checkpoint with a knife. Haaretz added the suspect then proceeded to attack a group of border police officers who were in the area, stabbing one of them. The commander of the police force then charged the suspect, who attempted to take his weapon and shot him dead, according to the statement. The Zionist regime's police force attempt to back up this narrative with a series of tweets, including a partially blurred photo of a face with a wound on it, allegedly that one of its officers, and another photo showing what the police claim is the knife used by the attacker. However, the Zionist regime police account contains at least one obvious lie, where it states that the terrorist was neutralized and his death was determined on the spot. Video shows that Mefleh was in fact still alive after he was repeatedly shot by border police officer, and his life might have been saved had the Zionist regime forces not obstructed medical care. The Zionist regime forces routinely deprive injured Palestinians of life-saving medical care, even after they pose no conceivable threat. International law requires that such care be provided promptly, and its willful denial or obstruction may be a war crime. The Zionist regime media stated that the officer who shot Mefleh and a border police officer who was allegedly stabbed were lightly injured. Palestinian media published an image showing the face of the officer who killed Mefleh. Shabati, the Zionist regime police, commanded the actions of the officer, as did Amer Cohen, the commander of the Zionist regime border police. Their quick endorsement of Mefleh's killing without even the pretense of an investigation will further reassure the Zionist regime personnel that they can continue to kill Palestinians in almost any circumstances with impunity. According to Wafa News Agency, the Zionist regime army killing of a Palestinian in the Hishe refugee camp in Beit Lah was highlighted on the front page of three Palestinian Arabic dailies published recently. A martyr and several injuries in the Hishe refugee camp, said the headline in Al-Quds Daily. A martyr by occupation army gunfire in the Hishe camp and clashed in confronting a raid of Jenin refugee camp, said Al-Yawm Arabic Daily in its main story headline. The third daily, Al Hayat Al Jadida also said one martyr and six wounded in the Hisha camp and the occupation demolished a mosque in Dora, Al Khalil area. The three papers printed a statement of condemnation by the Zionist regime, Prime Minister, of the Israeli army killing of Omar Yusuf Mana, 23, during a raid of the Hisha camp. And Al Hayat Al Jadida had a story about Mana, the baker, the impact of his killing on his family and friends. Al Hayat Al Jadida said that the Zionist regime army detained 19 Palestinians recently, issued a demolition order against a building with 9 apartments in Silvan neighborhood in occupied Istalqots, as well as 3 stores in the village of Beit Rima near Ramallah, and raided an elementary school in Ain Yabrut, also near Ramallah. It also said that Fatah Revolutionary Council continues its 10th session at presidential headquarters in Ramallah. Al-Yawm said 6 hours of hearing at magistrate court in Al-Quds exposed collusion between different Israeli bodies against Palestinian landowners in Silvan. It also warned that the powers granted to the fascist Israeli regime lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir will have serious repercussions on the life of Palestinians in the West Bank, East Al-Quds, and inside occupied territories, but more dangerous in East Al-Quds if it touches Al-Aqsa Mosque.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. The divine traditions are laws. How do laws work? The law is about a certain situation and it has a decree or a result. God satisfied our needs. The divine traditions are of different kinds and types. In one place he says, if you are grateful, I will certainly give more to you. In another he says, and if you are ungrateful, my chastisement is truly severe. This is chapter 14, verse 7. If we put up ourselves in that situation, being ungrateful, that result will come upon us. So both of these results are based on divine tradition, and it can work either way. Well, there are 2 cases referred to in chapter Ali Imran. It is strange that these 2 cases are both referred to in one chapter and are related to one event. Of course, there are 2 cases, but the 2 cases are related to one another. 2 kinds of traditions are referred to: the tradition of victory and the tradition of defeat. One is in verses 173 of chapter Ali Imran. Those to whom the people said, surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them. But this increased their faith. And they said, Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee. So they returned with favor from Allah. This is chapter 3, verses 173 to 174.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You have probably heard his story. The Battle of Uhud had finished. Someone like Hamza, Sayyid al-Shahada, had been martyred in this battle. The Prophet had been wounded. The commander of the faithful had been wounded. Many people had been martyred, tired, worn out, and wounded. They returned to Medina. The Quraysh, the same enemy who had failed to do anything and struck a blow, but they had not been able to defeat the Muslims. They gathered outside Medina, just a few kilometers away from Medina, and said, "We will attack tonight. They are tired and won't be able to do anything. We will finish them off." The agents went into Medina and started frightening the people. Those to whom the people said, "Surely men have gathered against you, therefore fear them." Chapter 3, verse 173. They came and asked the people, "Do you know what's happening? Have you heard? The enemy has gathered and has prepared an army. They want to put an end to you. They will attack tonight, and they will do this and do that." They, the enemy, were intimidating the people. Those who were the target of this intimidation said, "Allah is sufficient for us, and He is an excellent trustee." They said, "No, we aren't afraid of them. God is with us."
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Partisan politics in the U.S. leads to cruel treatment of migrants and freezing temperature. In the eyes of some American politicians, the migration issue is a voter-attracting banner in the elections, a weapon to attack their political opponents in partisan conflicts, and props to help build their image for political posturing. They never truly care about the migrants. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote in this regard, "For a country long suffering from partisan political rift on migration issue, the U.S. is celebrating Christmas with a new dilemma. Washington is stuck on a tightrope over migrants and doesn't know which way to go. On the one end is the most secure border in the history that former President Donald Trump boasted of, a situation achieved at the expense of human rights of migrants. And on the other is the greater chaos the Joe Biden administration is likely to face due to a surge of migrants. Several buses filled with over 100 migrants arrived near Vice President Kamala Harris' home in Washington, D.C., one of the coldest Christmas Eve on record in the nation's capital. The buses were reportedly sent by the Texas Division of Emergency Management, which follows instructions from Texas Governor Greg Abbott's office. It's not the first time Abbott and some other Republican governors have done similar stunts. Months ago, before the midterm elections, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Arizona Governor Doug Ducey transported migrants to regions run by Democrats, by buses, or even on planes. In response to Abbott's actions, more Democrat politicians blistered the Texas politician on Twitter, calling him heartless and saying dropping off migrants in below freezing temperatures is so cruel that it ought to be criminal. In a statement on Christmas Day, the White House also condemned Abbott's cruel, dangerous, and shameful stunt. But Democrats aren't doing anything more to stop such a tragedy other than simple criticism. It seems that none of the Democratic politicians are willing to genuinely welcome migrants into their homes. In fact, the migration reform that the Democratic Party mainly pushes for has hardly made any progress. And while the Democrats are about to lose their majority in the new House of Representatives, the Biden administration will face an even greater challenge from Republicans on the issue of migrants. Thus, it is reasonable to believe that the promised migration reforms will end up being just more lip service as difficulties mount. Although this year's midterm election is over, the U.S. is not far away from the elections in 2024. Many politicians from both parties are now making a big deal out of the migration issue to gain attention and earn more votes. For example, playing the migration card in a high-profile, dramatic, and provocative way is a typical election strategy for the Republican Party. It aims to persuade Republican supporters and even floating voters that the seemingly looser migration policies of the Biden administration are hypocritical and against the will of Americans. The Democrats, at the same time, attack their rivals using the topic and shouting empty slogans about the so-called liberal and democratic values. Political snowmanship over the migration issue has intensified in the U.S. following Trump. The Republican Party used to urge the country to build a wall at the borders, and now it transports migrants around as if they are some kind of unwanted items. The Democratic Party is no better. It also uses migration as a card in its political game, with the GOP making promises it apparently can't keep. The two parties have been engaging in endless haggling and shifting of responsibility over the migration issue for decades. It is almost impossible to carry out migration reform in the U.S. due to structural contradictions. In a country where its politics generally revolves around elections, a political party has to serve the interests of its core voters. For the GOP, it would mainly be white conservatives, and for the Democratic Party, liberal minorities. As a result, all these two parties do is debate and fight without actually solving the problems. In the eyes of some American politicians, the migration issue is a voter-attracting banner in the elections, a weapon to attack their political opponents in partisan conflicts, and props up to help build their image for political posturing. They never truly care about the migrants. the political grandstanding has stolen the due limelight of solving the actual problem. This is entirely unfair to the migrants who suffer from the crisis and need attention to improve their situation. It is ironic to see politicians from a country that was built and prospered with the help of countless migrants regard the latter simply as a tool to advance their political interests. And since the U.S. shines so brightly as a beacon, it is clear that its indifference toward migrants has set a bad example for other countries around the world with huge migrant populations. Meanwhile, Xinhua wrote, on the coldest Christmas Eve ever recorded in Washington, D.C., roughly 140 migrants were dropped off outside the residence of U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. The migrants, including women and children, reportedly arrived in three buses at the Naval Observatory where Harris lives in the U.S. Capitol recently. The arrivals included asylum seekers from a number of Central American and Caribbean countries. Some of them were not wearing adequate winter clothes while Washington, D.C. was witnessing the coldest Christmas in more than two decades. According to videos circulated on social media, the migrants allegedly sent from U.S. state of Texas were given white blankets to keep themselves warm while waiting to be transferred to a local church. Washington, D.C. had a cold weather emergency alert in place throughout the Christmas weekend due to a historic winter storm, with government officials asking residents to limit their time outdoors and dress warmly. Amy Fisher, the organizer of a U.S. migrant aid network, said that the migrants don't have coats and that they don't have clothes for this kind of weather and they are freezing. Fisher's network tweeted recently that it was Texas Governor Greg Abbott who bussed the shelter seekers outside the official residence of Harris in freezing cold. Abbott is among at least three Republican governors who have transferred migrants from their states to cities led by Democrats this year to protest U.S. President Joe Biden's immigration policies and what they called federal inaction to secure America's southern border. His office said last month that the Texas state government is taking aggressive action to aid border communities, including busing thousands of migrants to Washington, D.C., New York City, Chicago, and Philadelphia. White House spokesperson Abdullah Hassan pointed a finger at Abbott's administration, calling the busing of migrants a cruel, dangerous, and shameful stunt. Governor Abbott abandoned children on the side of the road in below freezing temperatures on Christmas Eve without coordinating with any federal or local authorities, Hassan said. According to Alejandro Portes, a University of Miami law professor, there are 12 million undocumented immigrants already in the U.S., and every attempt to bring about some process of regularization has been blocked in Congress by the far-right wing of the Republican Party over the past several administrations.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Iranian army repels American vessels trying to violate Iran's southern waters. This is one of the scenarios of the first phase of a massive naval drill staged by the Iranian army's navy. Codenamed Zulfaghar, The maneuver is conducted over an area stretching from the Persian Gulf Strait of Hormuz to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The large-scale Zulfiqar maneuver is underway with the goal of integrating our network of armed forces and testing our naval defense capabilities. In this drill, we have carried out different defensive and offensive operations using our own domestically developed military equipment.
The drill involved all of the four branches of the Iranian army in 3 days of exercises. On the first day, the Navy conducted beaching or amphibious operations, which involved Marines in an operation ashore aimed at assaulting the enemy's coastal units.
Beaching an amphibious operation is an Iranian initiative which has long been adopted by different navies around the world. It's an effective way of breaking into the enemy's coast. Beaching has advanced over time according to the advances in the hardware, but the idea and the way it's implemented remains the same.
The first phase of the maneuver saw the use of the latest hardware built domestically by the Iranian armed forces, including surveillance and reconnaissance drones such as Ababil 3 and Mohajer 6, which can also conduct tactical and combat missions. The drill also involved the use of surface-to-surface missiles such as Dehlaviye guided missile to protect the Iranian beach against the enemy's amphibious operations.
The Iranian Navy says this is a routine drill which is staged every year to boost its naval force and fine-tune its homegrown military equipment. It says using its weapons, it is now fully prepared to confront any threat to Iran's territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
South Korea plans to significantly boost military spending over the next 5 years, an annual increase of nearly 7%. The Eastern Asian country aims to spend over $440 million on anti-drone weapons alone. The announcement comes only days after North Korea flew drones into the South's territory for the first time in 5 years.
According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Monday, five North Korean drones crossed the border before breaking formation. Four of them headed to islands in the West Sea, while one of the drones continued south, reaching the skies over the outskirts of this city, the capital, Seoul.
It was the first such incident since 2017 when a drone crossed into South Korea and photographed a U.S. base here. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who came to office in May of this year, has blamed the previous progressive government's policy of engaging Pyongyang for the recent incident.
Given that efforts or military training to respond to such UAV drones have never been properly done since 2017, I think our people must have well seen how dangerous a policy relying on the North's good faith and peace agreements would be.
South Korea plans more joint military exercises with the U.S. for 2023, although much of the public wants talks with North Korea and a de-escalation of tensions. Meanwhile, North Korea has unveiled new goals for the country's military. Addressing a large committee meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, leader Kim Jong-un indicated on Wednesday that the country will continue its military development in 2023 after a record year of missile testing. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's far-right government is about to adopt a security decree that will introduce a compulsory code of conduct for NGO-run ships rescuing asylum seekers in the Mediterranean Sea. Since day one of its mandate, the Giorgia Meloni government has pledged to press ahead with an agenda aimed at stopping what it calls irregular migration. The new measures will force NGO-run ships to deliver rescued asylum seekers to port immediately without waiting to pick up more people at sea or transferring asylum seekers to larger vessels. Under the new rules, rescued people will also have to apply for asylum in the country where the NGO